The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere. This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the pod of thunder and rock and roll, and today is the day. It's finally arrived. It's been a long time coming, but it's here at last. The biggest podcast ever with Mick Foley. We've been talking about this for a year. We've been promoting it for a year, and it's finally happening. We started 367 days ago because it's wrestling. We couldn't get our shit together, and we're still 2 days late, but it doesn't matter. Like I said, it's been a long time coming, but he's here at last. Mick Foley has arrived.
Talk is Jericho.
All right, after 365 days plus two in typical wrestling time, we didn't even get it right in 365 days. We have the biggest podcast ever with Mick Foley. Can you remember when we announced this? We did a little preview.
I do. Yeah, we previewed it, and the world, what the world's been talking about for a year.
It's been off the charts. It's on the front page of USA Today that we're finally doing this. I remember that it was you were going to interview Shane, I think, for one of those like kind of a, they call them like podcasts, even though they're
not
podcasts.
Vince, the deal is no one has been able to break it to Mr. McMahon that it's only a podcast if it's on a podcast. Otherwise, it's an interview.
I told him that. I said, do you understand, Vince, a podcast is audio? He's like, no, a podcast is a shoot interview. I'm like, it's really not, though. But to him, it was the podcast, so okay.
So therefore, every podcast in existence is a shoot interview.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So I remember we announced it that whole year ago, and here we are finally in the Joe Louis Arena.
And I'm not at the top of my game.
What's the matter?
I was expressing to you, this 31 years in the business, why did I take a signing in Fargo, North Dakota? We're supposed to be in the city, right? And
right.
This is one of my biggest Raws, maybe the biggest Raw I've had as GM, and I took a signing. I just remember being asked about a signing and not saying no. I don't remember specifically saying yes. And then I got the ticket. I was like, I don't know. I can't. Maybe I said yes. I don't know.
Fargo is in the middle. Fargo's like, that's where we used to travel from Winnipeg if you wanted to go to the States for the weekend.
Yeah.
But it's about 5 hours from Winnipeg. It's in the middle of nowhere.
And it's 4 hours from Minneapolis. Let me put it here. I left my hotel in Syracuse, and then you know, 2 hours ahead of time, give yourself 2 hours. About an hour and a half to Detroit, missed my connection by 5 minutes because the flight from Syracuse was delayed. So wait around 2.5 hours. I catch that next flight, which is about a 2-hour flight, and then it takes about an hour in Minneapolis to get my car, and then it's 4 hours.
Why don't they just fly you to Fargo? They have an airport there.
Yeah, I could have used that.
something you could have told
info,
me yesterday.
Yeah, something I could have told you yesterday. and I just, I was the whole way up, I just had one thought, and it was me asking myself, what were you thinking? Like, this is not a rookie mistake. This is a rookie mistake being made by a 31-year veteran.
Going, ribbing yourself. And I'm sure the payoff was nice, but it's not like it was some exorbitant amount where you couldn't say no.
I should have said no. I think the closest I've come to this, and probably a bigger mistake in retrospect, was choosing to do an independent show the night before I wrestled Stone Cold on the main event of a pay-per-view in Milwaukee. And it was from Ohio to, it was a 10-hour drive. It wasn't 1,000 miles, but it was a 10-hour drive working with Knobs, the night before Stone Cold. Like, a guy who will proudly admit he's one of the sloppiest guys in the business. I'm working with Knobs before I
worked with Steve. So you were working, was it a WWE pay-per-view?
At that time, yeah, it was WWE pay-per-view, and it was a heck of a match. It was the one we had... And now you say the one where Undertaker got involved. Pat Patterson was the guest. Vince was the guest referee. He did an unbelievable. He did an unbelievable job. He was in the boys' medium referee shirt. Saw it afterwards. Boys' medium stretched out to breaking point. And he did the great thing where he was like, "That's right, these hands and these." And then he was showing off the guns, and he was like, "Hitting the tricep. He was, these hands will count to one, two, three, and so for the finish." Steve hit us both with stunners, and then he took Vince's hand and
he counted to three.
Yeah, it was a pretty epic match. But again, I was like, "What was I thinking?"
So, what were you allowed to take independent bookings?
For some reason, the office decided we could do independent. I don't know why. I don't know why. It was probably a bad move, and they stopped doing that. You know, but I guess they let guys make a little extra money on their days off.
You know what's funny, though? You mentioned the Stone Cold and Vince, and I had forgotten, I mean, with all the great feuds that you had and all the stuff, I forgot, was this around the time when you became, like, corporate Mick Foley?
Oh, yeah.
Tell us about that. I kind of remember.
It was a nice run. Let me see. I had done the corporate thing. Well, Dude Love in 97 had come about because Steve kept on... rejecting me in my attempts to be his tag team partner. Mm-hmm. And I would show up and I'd have a sign that said, "Pick me, Steve." And I would help him make comebacks against, you know, a number of adversaries, and I'd get stunned. You know, Steve was not real big on the pat on the back, you know.
Yeah.
I believe that it just led me to crack. And Vince had really become a fan. I'm convinced Vince became a fan of mine. I even said this on the special that I'd been told by Al Snow that you could never really be a big star in WWE until Mr. McMahon personally got on board, until he
became
a fan.
Yeah.
And that wasn't the case up until I did the interview with JR, and it went so well. They divided into like six segments. And I remember after the first week, I was driving with Steve Austin, and he was kind of a loner, you know? Like, it wasn't like I rode with him that much. We were good friends, but Steve was kind of a... on his own a lot, and unlike, you know, in WCW, where everybody rode together, you know, it was kind of a big community there, but when guys are, you know, I remember, like, when Cat was on top, Wildcat Wendell Cooley reference.
Very obscure.
This should sell out. But you know, when guys get on top, they have a tendency, I think, to go off on their own, you know, and they cut their promos in the car and always thinking about what they're doing.
On your own schedule,
yeah.
And time, yeah.
But Steve said, "Kid, what are they doing? They turn your baby face." I said, "No, I think it's just a way to allow people to understand the character a little bit better." And he goes, "You'll be a baby face in 3 weeks." And sure enough, no turn. There was no turn. It was just the fans every week were cheering more. And then I started working with Hunter, the 97 Hunter. You know, this is like both looking for the break and not working quite on top, but really having good, solid matches. And he was like the perfect guy to put over that era Mankind. But it wasn't until Vince had heard that I'd been this Dude Love character. It was Shawn Michaels asking me. He goes, he didn't want to insult me. He goes, "Let me ask you this." He goes, "Is this the way you always like... imagined yourself?" Looking at the Mankind, you know, when I had the hair torn out of my head and the wild bumps, I said, "No, I wanted to be you." And Bruce Pritchard happened to be there overhearing the conversation. I told him about the evolution of Dude Love when I was younger, you know, 18 years old.
So Dude Love was the character that you
Dude
played
Love
when
was
you
the
were a teenager.
I played, and like, not just, it wasn't a backyard wrestling thing, even though I did, you know, a couple of, you know, home videos where I was Dude Love, and it was more like in the editing. We didn't have actual match, well, one actual match, but we would edit them and put in like little clips of wrestling magazines with my face. You couldn't. It was no, you know,
it was a Photoshop.
It wasn't no Photoshop. It was just me going through enough photos, finding the right magazine. Because I had hundreds of magazines. I'd find a frame that kind of looked really the thing, and you know, there was one that looked really good. My face over Don Morocco's
body.
Yeah, body. And when Vince found out that I'd wanted to be this guy, and that I had video, it just kind of got his mind working. And he became really, I don't want to say enamored, because I don't want to use any word to describe Mr. McMahon that isn't super cool and mod. I don't want to say he became enamored with, yeah. but he became really interested, and he wanted to make that. And that's when he had he kind of admitted that the real life story I had was more interesting than Mankind, which at the time was a fictional character with a fictional background. They didn't pay any attention to things I'd done as if what I had done had never existed. That was the way the way it was. And I think he deserves a lot of credit. I'm not just saying that because he currently employs me for about another week, the way things are going. But he really did, you know. I think he's shown that he will admit when he's wrong about something. And in this case, he realized that, you know, the story I had to offer was an interesting one. And I told the story in the Cheap Pops special where I didn't know this till Bruce Prichard told me. I knew that Mr. McMahon had not been a fan of mine. But he said it was finally Jim Ross was kind of just like steady, you know, just steady, not relentless, but steady. You know, what about Mick Foley? What about Cactus Jack? And Bruce said it was the fall of 1995. And Vince was slammed his hand down on the table and went, all right, I'll bring him in, but I'm covering up his face. And that was Mankind.
So, you keep mentioning this. Why did Vince not like you?
You know, Vince is he's a gut player, you know? I mean, he gets a gut feeling and didn't think I looked like a star. And Bruce told me, he was, in retrospect, you know, years later, he goes, remember when I saw you at LaGuardia when you were with, you know, WCW? He was like, yeah. He goes, did you know Vince was right there? And I said, no. And he was nowhere to be seen. I said, where was he? He goes, well, when I said, hey, there's Cactus Jack, would you like to say hello? And he says, I don't think I ever want to meet him.
Really?
So in a way, maybe he was sold on the character too.
Huh.
But, you know, I like to think that I kind of struck a blow for the unlikely guy. Mm-hmm. You know, I would call up once a year, talk to J.J. Dillon. And I should not have blamed JJ in my book. You know, you're kind of writing. You know how powerful you feel when you get that pen going, sure. or keyboard. It's like you're getting stuff out. You should edit that stuff out when you're reading it.
Well, you're the one who told me a book is not the place to
settle a score.
Settle a score.
Yeah.
Great advice I still use to this day.
Do you remember when we'll put each other over now?
Yeah.
I'm kind of putting myself. I guess it's, you don't mind if I put myself over.
Well, you have to.
Well, you said, hey, Mike, would you mind giving me a blurb? You don't have to read the book, right?
Yeah.
I had this thing where I was like, wow, I have to read the book. I can't put my name on something. I haven't read it. And then I called you up, and I was like, you've got a really good book here, but can mm-hmm. I give you some advice? You're like, sure.
Dude, you went through,
sat on the phone
page by page, I remember.
8 hours, right?
We were talking page by page. Said there was too much swearing in it, which you were right. Don't settle vendettas or settle scores or start vendettas. And great, great advice that I use. I just finished my fourth book. I still use those words that you gave me.
I'm so lucky. I have a Christmas memoir coming out, so I stay one step ahead of you.
We'll talk about it. But we'll talk about it. I want to go back to the J.J. Dillon. So you said you shouldn't have blamed him.
No, I shouldn't have blamed him. He was just the messenger.
What was he telling you?
He would say, well, we're not looking for talent. And then I would watch Monday Night Raw, and I'd be like, I'd see Mantar, Duke the Dumpster Drozzi, and I'm like, I think they're lying to me.
Yeah.
And it was hard to accept that they just weren't interested, you know? Like, when I was doing my thing in ECW, like the anti-hardcore gimmick, there was not a thought. I was doing a thing. I don't know if you remember the promos I was doing with Tommy Dreamer, but the idea was I was essentially like Jacob Marley to Tommy's Ebenezer Scrooge, trying to save him from the mistakes I'd made. Because I had left WCW under less than ideal circumstances and didn't think I could ever go back there. Tommy had been asked, turned it down because he was the ECW, you know, faithful guy. And that's bad business. You know, that's the guys who stayed. And I loved ECW. But can you imagine what they chanted to you, please don't go.
They did it
to everybody. Can you imagine if guys said, well, I guess I can't go. You know,
and like, some of them did, like you said, Tommy. You know, I think Taz for the longest time wouldn't do it. And Sabu wouldn't do it. You know, it's just,
maybe missed the boat. You know?
Right.
Got their shot. Oh, and, you know, Tommy's, man, very highly respected, and Sabu's had great years. And but I think had you and I not gone when we did, you know, we're not sitting around doing this podcast, or we're doing it like in someone's basement, looking at the Joe Louis Arena.
At the signing in Fargo.
Yeah, but I was doing the angle, like, you know how things are. The things usually go well. They're at their best when there's some realism, you know, fueling the emotions. And I firmly believed I would never have a shot at again at WCW, or if I did, it would be in as a like kind of a, you know, revved up enhancement guy. And I just I didn't think the cards. It was in the cards for me to be in WWE. I've been rejected there so many times. So I was going with don't make the mistakes I've made, and doing it in like pretty convincing, you know, psychological fashion. And then I got the call during that run about from WWE, and went over there and met with Mr. McMahon, and he had and I didn't go to the house. You know that.
Yeah, you went to the house. Yeah.
If you go to the house, they've got big plans for you. Office, you're like, you might be okay.
Right.
And then if you meet with an assistant, you know.
Where did you meet him?
I met at the office.
Okay.
So, like, I think it was indicative of the push I was supposed to get, you know. I mean, there were other guys, you know, coming in. And I'm not picking on Mark Merrill, because I've made my peace with Mark. It wasn't his fault that he got a great contract. But,
right.
you know, Vince would, you know, give more attention to the guys he thought were going to be the backbone of the company. And so you had, you know, guys like me and Stone Cold who were not.
You were not earmarked to be the stars that you
and
became.
And this is the story I've told in the 99 book, where I was at what they call the tent towns of Cohasset, Massachusetts.
Yeah, we used to do those.
Yeah,
that's right. The tent
them.
Tours, yeah.
Loved them. And one of the highlights was...
And what those were, just so people didn't know, you would have shows basically underneath tents in small, like, Rhode Island cities for, like, you know, wine festivals or whatever. There'd be a tent show.
So they would only be up there in the summer, you know, 2-3 months out of the year. And they were fun. They had a great atmosphere. The ceiling would be really low. And you could get away with doing things at those shows you could never get away with, like, at the Garden. Like, for example, you know, I was having a match with Triple H in that 97 feud, and I had the salad tongs out. You know, I could make good use, liberal use of the salad tongs. And I don't want to give away too much here and insinuate that wrestlers communicate with each other.
But
on this
times.
One occasion, I heard Triple H go, "Beel me," beel toss, and he's like feeding me his nose. He's going up the top rope. They reach up with the salad tongs, grab him by the nose. It's one of the things. It's almost like the catapult, where you know it can't work, but you suspend disbelief, and it's like, my goodness, I had the big extended throw. You know, it's like, whoa, way over there. He took a hell of a bump. But that was 97. 96, as heel Mankind, you know, characters, he was starting to get over, you know. I had a couple of good pay-per-views with Undertaker, and Jimmy Miranda, who was the head of merchandise at the time, he sat me down and he said, you know, the company would like to have some Mankind merchandise. And they had about 30 different products. And my name was marked off on like two. It was a T-shirt and a mask.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I don't think I should have a mask, because the mask is supposed to be scary. It's not something a kid should be able to buy. That's like really idealistic thinking, you know.
Right.
And then as you get older, you just go, all right, give me the money, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Wear the mask. Put this mask on, kid.
And guys like Barry Windham probably had 20 items marked off. Big plans for Barry as the Stalker. Mark Henry, every box was checked. And Steve walks over, hey, Miranda, how about some merchandise for Stone Cold? And Jimmy kind of got a little, you know, uncomfortable. He goes, what's wrong, Miranda? He goes, Steve, the office just doesn't see a lot of marketing potential in you.
Unbelievable, right?
Unbelievable, right? And then that's just further proof that Vince, you know, he sees things happening. He adapts along the way.
I remember actually we're here in Joe Louis Arena. I always want to say Joe Louis Arena for some reason, but Joe Louis Arena.
The voice app. Have reached Joe Louis
Arena. But this is the first pay-per-view that John Cena ever had here against me. And I remember I called Vince the night before and I said, you got to change the finish. He has to win. You know, he's this upcoming guy, good looking guy. And Vince is like, what do you see in him? I'm saying, I'm telling you, the kid's got something. You know, you have to put him over in this. It doesn't matter if I beat him, everyone expects it. If he beats me, it could help him.
Right.
I was arguing with Vince McMahon to put John Cena over on me in Joe Louis Arena. So that just shows, I think it takes some time for him to, I mean, it happened to me.
Was this before he started rapping?
Yeah. It's when he was just nondescript, basically tights and boots John Cena.
And the story I hear is that Stephanie heard him freestyle rapping on the bus.
On the bus, yeah. And on tour in Europe or something, yeah.
We can do something with this.
Yeah.
And then I'd watch John, and I was like, it was really entertaining. And I remember saying to people, but he's not going to really draw money until he needed that to get his foot in the door.
Sure.
And established him. And it was like, but then he needs to be able to make points that are not punchlines.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, man, you know, now I watch the show. I mean, I grudgingly admit that SmackDown has some great episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got this great thing going where, you know, guys like Miz will Miz and AJ, well, they'll cut great promos. And then John gets to go second.
Mm-hmm.
And he just nails it.
He bats cleanup, yeah.
He bats cleanup. And, you know, to me, he's one of the best promo guys out there. A lot of fans don't want to admit that. And I kind of got that was the first time I got a real feel for, like, how strong the Cena resentment was, like real resentment, because I was in Florida. I was working for TNA. I was watching Monday Night Raw. He just nailed a promo. And so I wrote, you know, maybe I had 10,000 followers at that time on Twitter, and I said, great promo by John Cena. I think more people need to recognize his legacy of, you know, jumping around promo to matches. And then at that time, I could see how many messages came in. I don't know why I can't anymore. And I said to my daughter, I said, I just got 600 messages, like within minutes, like 1 or 2 minutes. She goes, that's impossible. I said, let me try it again. And I said, I saw that they were, you know, some, a lot of negative ones. I said, oh, yeah, well, try to find a bad John Cena pay-per-view. And then they all responded with the same pay-per-view. And I said, well, that's the exception that proves the rule.
Yeah, then
it was, well, he just had good opponents to carry him. I said, so he's had good opponents every month
for eight years?
That was like our my high school lacrosse team was a powerhouse. This guy, Joe Cuso, was the coach, and he's the winningest high school coach of all time. And I'd hear, like, as my friends grew up and had kids in the system, they're like, he doesn't know how to coach. He just has great players. I said, so he's had great players every year for 30 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, I thought, John, he's doing well enough without me pushing him, right?
Well, yeah,
John
of course. Yeah, of course. But this brings up something that we were just talking about earlier about how you just deleted your Twitter app off your phone.
Because this is breaking news, just happening
maybe today. But you were talking about how there's a lot of negativity on Twitter, which there is.
Yeah.
You had enough of it?
Yeah. You know, it's still really valuable. Like, you get your pulse on something. But until I stop being the GM, I swear it's just a exercise in, like, masochism.
People yelling at you for stuff that's happening on the show.
Yeah.
That, of course, you're not really in charge of, not to insinuate.
You know, we give voice to ideas that are reached by a consensus.
Yes.
And then you go out there. And it's a crazy thing is to say, oh, I'm not really the GM, is not altogether true because, I mean, you know what? It's a good experience from my son to watch me and you and Kevin. And I think it was just the three of us. We had a segment. And it turned out to be a very, very good segment. It was coming off the Hell in a Cell, and you'd had the Key of Jericho.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to buzz me because I completely forgot to talk about the key. And you're like, I see you twirling it. You're like, yeah, you're just
the key, Mick.
The key.
See the key? See it?
So what I do is funny. When the first time I went out there with Stephanie, right, I said to her, but 2 minutes beforehand, I said, Stephanie, I said, look, I'm probably going to forget things out there, and I'm not going to panic because I know it's going to happen, but just be aware that it will happen, and you may need to give me a couple of buzzwords. But what I didn't tell her was it's probably going to happen within the first 15 seconds of me being out there. And somebody says to me, like, the next day, goes, did Stephanie say 5-alarm fire to you? And yes, she did. Because I said, 5-alarm fire. Responded to it like it was a 5-alarm fire. And so I need a little help. And then once I have that little bit of help, you know, it can push me through.
Mm-hmm.
But he saw that, you know, we were able to negotiate and, you know, talk to the writers, understand they have a difficult job, but they can't give it the words, the same voice that we can. and you don't want to crush them, you know. I mean, no one wants to have their work wadded up in a ball and thrown on the ground, you know, like some guys do. And he really liked that. I like to think we're two, you know, better, you know.
Guys, make it work.
It would make it work, and it was fun because it was a really productive environment. I think that's when the best things get done. And so you're like me, when you really believe in something, you know, you more so than me because you're out there every week and you've got the matches and the angles. I have to pick my spots. Mm-hmm. Like Stephanie and I had a major victory, major in early September, when they basically wanted me to call her out on being a liar, and the lines would have been drawn 6 weeks into the, you know, relationship, and there'd be nowhere to go.
Mm-hmm.
And Stephanie had talked to Vince. Vince wasn't buying anything. I went and talked to Vince for about 20 minutes. I got like 1/10 of what I wanted. And then I walked out, and Stephanie said, let's shoot it. I said, what do you mean? She goes, let's shoot it. We'll show it to my father later. And we did it. It was a really intense, it was a very emotional thing that Vince was not in favor of at all. And we didn't, you know, we didn't write anything down. We just went for it. And then Vince sees us shooting it, and he comes over, and we have basically gone behind his back.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, Dad, and we shot something, like you look at it. And I start walking away. He goes, where the hell are you going? I went, I'll be right here next to you. It's about a 3-minute and 30-second promo. He doesn't say a word. And even about 30 seconds, or at least it seemed like 30, seemed like longer, you know. He doesn't say anything, and he finally goes, we'll do it your way.
Mm.
And he walks slowly away, and Road Dogg comes over to me, and Stephanie goes, y'all know you can't ask for anything for like 2 months. And so that's the way it is. You got to pick your battles.
You're right.
And be willing to go full tilt. So there are times, I like to think that on the occasions where I really feel strongly about something, the people at home will go, I think he meant that. And you can't go there every time you're doing that, because then you become the boy who cried wolf, you know. But there have been 4 or 5 occasions I'm really, you know, proud of, where I, you know, stood up, explained why I wanted to do it, why I thought I should do it myself, apologized to the writers and said, this is something I need to do. And so you do have a voice. But by and large, you're giving voice to something that's you haven't arrived at by yourself. And it's like the irony of the people who think they're smart to the business, like blaming me. And it just, you know, I was maybe spoiled, because if I'd gotten on social media when I was a heel, then I would have been used to it, you know. But I was used to being pretty well liked, you know, and like the guy with the, you know, oh, still trying to be relevant. That was kind of the exception. And then it got to where I was like, well, now it's like, you know, it's pretty constant. It's just like walking, and it feels like somebody like swatting you in the ankles with sticks, you know, like you're not crippling. You're like, oh, that hurts.
Stop. And that's what people have to understand, that everything we do, it goes through the pipeline of being approved by Vince.
Yeah.
So, and that's where it starts, and that's where it stops. So no matter what it is, people mad at me for distracting Kevin Owens for a 3-second match. Believe me, it's not my decision.
Well,
you know,
one of the things that, you know, when I say I took it off my phone, that means now I just have to make more of an effort to log on.
You're not just going to go out and stop at a traffic light and look through.
Yeah, let me say, oh, okay, that stung a little bit. And one of the things was the guys who'd been over to Japan quite a bit for New Japan, Gallows and Anderson, told me that one of their friends had done the move and been paralyzed from the neck down. And so, man, you know, that hits close to home. There were a couple times where I had to lay there on the ground and
really
try to, yeah, just like, okay, I can move my fingers, I could, because, you know, there were some, you know,
stingers
things where I just one time when I tried to give Shoji Nakamaki, or Nakamaki Shoji as they say in Japan, a clothesline over the top in a barbed wire match.
Oof.
And we had done it one other time, and it looked, you know, it looked sick, a lot of danger there. You know, I'd had my arm wrapped in case I caught it, so it didn't just tear from, you know, meat from the bone. And in this case, we hit it for the clothesline, and the wire snapped. So it's not meant to hold that kind of weight. Mm. And I remember seeing the picture in the Japanese magazine, my feet straight up in the air, you know, just landing right on my head.
Straight on your head, yeah.
And so you're vaguely aware that the audience is responding, whoa, you know, that kind of, you know, nice wave of sound. And I'm laying there, I'm like, I'm going to see, you know, there's been probably 3 times that was one of them. You know, you're like, okay, fingers, 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 toes, toes, toes. And the logical thing, and this is like what I say, you know, I don't want to use the word irony too often. I don't want to, you know, but it's ironic that we're like the fake sport, yet mm-hmm. we're the one where guys go, okay, can I move? Can I move? Nice. Okay, let's go. Not let's get somebody out there.
Yeah.
And we need
to get off the field.
It's important now that we have that. You know, we have people looking out for us, you know. Because it's kind of, if you love it and you break in like we did, you know, going to the territories and being proud of the fact that, there's a guy in Florida, back when I lived in the Florida Panhandle, he was taking a long time in our pool. And he was like, hey, there's nothing I could do. People quit. I mean, you know, your car breaks down, you don't make it to the show. And I'm like, no, that's where you're wrong. My car breaks down. I take the license plate off and I leave it on the side of the road and I put my thumb out and I make it to the show. And it sounds like you sound like you're psychotic, but like if you were wired any other way, you wouldn't make it because there'd be other guys who would. And if you were the guy who's going to say, I need a break, I need time out, I'm not sure if I can move my limbs, someone else is going to
come in, is going to
take that spot.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
This is Talk is Jericho.
You know, you're such a the lovable Mick Foley, the general manager, loves Santa Claus, have a nice day. Does it almost seem like a different person that was the guy that would do exploding barbed wire matches or, you know, the famous bump off the Hell in the Cell? Do you look back at that sometimes and go like, who was this guy?
In some ways I do. And I think I convinced myself that I was just playing an extension of myself, mm-hmm. you know, and with the dial turned up. And I maybe because I did it for so long, it did become part of who I was. But it was a long way from what I was naturally. Mm-hmm. And one of the most difficult things I had to do was overcome my natural lack of aggression. Hmm. You know, and when I wonder how I made it, I sometimes go like, how did I survive in the dressing room? Like I didn't hunt, I didn't fish, I didn't have a big dog, I drove
don't
a minivan. Yeah, I didn't drink.
Don't
yeah, I rarely
drugs,
drank. Yeah, I didn't curse.
Yeah,
and there were some people.
That's right, you don't curse.
Nah,
I never noticed
rarely,
that before.
Rarely. Yeah. I would do my one man show, and I would drop the one F-bomb at the end. I would realize when I go out there and I would curse in my shows, I'm like, this is a crutch. It's a crutch. And then I would just try to specify that there'd be one. And I was like, I'd treat it like DDP in the Diamond Cutter, like, or Randy Orton in the RKO, like out of nowhere. And then if I hit it right, it was this great feeling of satisfaction. You know, I had like six or seven different ways I could go into it. Mm-hmm. And then if I forgot, I would thank everybody and I just walk out and go, oh, boom, hit the F-bomb, and people would give me a standing ovation.
And see, because you built it up.
I built it up.
It was the biggest F-bomb ever. Yeah.
But I do wonder that, because even though I had the assortment of cool bumps, you know, going back to like the late 80s, like I wasn't an aggressive heel, you mm-hmm. know, and they realized you have to be able to get heat for those bumps to mean something, because if you can't get people to dislike you, to get emotionally invested, then you're just a body doing things, you know. Mm. And it was, I remember Terry Funk, you know, in sitting me down in 1990, February, you could look up Ric Flair's birthday, because it was 42nd birthday. How I scored an invite to Rick's birthday party, I don't know. and guys at that time were, you know, kind of putting me over because the bumps I were doing, they were, you know, really unusual at that time. So a lot of it's kind of standard stuff now, but at that time it was really unusual. And Terry Funk took exception, you know, but it'd be really easy to say, I mean, you're doing a great job. And he gave me this, you know, parable, you know, about the devil and the angel. And basically, the angel saying, without him, there is no me. And he was like, Norman, it was Norman the Lunatic, Mike Shaw. Mm-hmm. Norman was an angel out there, but you were not the devil. And he told me if I couldn't find a way to, you know, to tap into something there, you know, that all the bumps essentially were going to be meaningless.
Yeah.
And there was a real deciding point for me. I mean, I look at it, even though I had already gotten a fairly aggressive, but it was the King of the Deathmatch tournament in August of 95. And it's gone down in lore. And I had Nakamaki Shoji under a bed of nails outside. He was outside the ring. And I had it positioned in a way that, you know, my body weight was not going to come down on most of the nails. Mm-hmm. But I remember, like, specifically thinking, like, okay, I have to choose whether to take perfect care of him or to make this look good. And I made the conscious decision to make it look good. And I dropped that elbow. It wasn't ridiculous, you know, like some guys. It wasn't, I would like to say it wasn't a liberty, but he was underneath a bed of nails. And I remember him screaming, and the nails, you know, two or three of them are dug in. And it was almost like this, I was in the zone, and it was like, cool, you know. And I like, oh, and I used that feeling when I did a promo with Randy Orton, which I think was one of the best.
I remember
it. Yeah, in the rocking chair. And I was essentially talking about how I did these things, convinced myself that I did them to pay a mortgage. But then you look at the video, and like, I remember Rick, you know, Rick Patterson, right? Mm-hmm. He was a Winnipeg guy.
Oh, well, Rick Patterson.
He was Leatherface there. Leatherface, and Rick would hold the guy in a backbreaker. I'd come off with the elbow, and the arm would be wrapped in barbed wire, you know, and I'm taking care of the guy, but there's only so much you can do.
There's barbed wire coming down.
It's real barbed wire coming down from a distance. And I would hit that thing and look at that camera and bang, bang. And I'd look and I go, that's not a guy paying his mortgage. That's a guy who's into what he's
You're
doing.
You're into it.
Yeah.
That's a little bit psychotic.
Yeah. But if you don't, if you're not all in,
see, I can understand that. In 2008, when I was doing that thing of the suit and tie heel Jericho with Shawn Michaels and the whole thing, I remember coming back through the curtain. I would have to go to a corner or a room by myself and come out of this character. I was dropped in so deep. Like, when I went out there, I was the biggest son of a bitch, asshole, ruthless. You know what I mean? I felt it to where I was it. And I had to calm down. I didn't just walk in and go, hey, dude. Like, I had to calm down. Like, stop it. Like, it's acting. We're playing this character. And they would say you're dropping in.
No, we're not acting.
Yeah.
Because you look down on it, and then you realize the lengths that great actors go to play their roles.
Right.
And it's like, even if it's method acting, you're still – and it took me a while to accept, all right, maybe I was acting because I'm not that guy, you know, who did all that wild stuff. And real good – he doesn't write anymore. His name's Tim Kale. He used to be right – the only knock on his stuff is it was so in depth that you had to really follow it, because he was very analytical. And he taught, and he wrote about how the Santa was much closer to who I am than these mankind, where I would have to go, like, you would find a place to decompress. I would have to go into a place, you know, and do the rocking and sit in the boiler room. This is, before it got to be, habit. And it was like, I'm not this guy. I'm not a guy who lived in a basement, who broke all his own fingers. Like, I don't have anything in common with this guy, but I've got to find something. And it would require me going off and kind of trying to become that guy.
How did Vince pitch that character to you?
The thing is, I did sign away when I left the company early. They let me out of my contract in 2001, a year early, and they wanted me to sign away the rights to the characters. I was like, no, I was Dude Love when I was 18. I was Cactus Jack for 12 years. It hurt me to write that Mankind was theirs, because essentially, I want to get heat with it, but they came up with an idea for a mask, and then again, to Vince's credit, he. And I didn't know him that well. I was just pitching ideas. And luckily, I had been informed what my name was going to be by the woman in creative who was going with me to, the sixth floor of a walk-up in Brooklyn to Stanley Sherman's. He was the mask guy. And if Stanley's listening, I'll apologize for saying he was a short guy, because he was actually 6'6". In my mind, he was an odd guy, but he was a heck of a mask maker. And I remember one time I'm skipping around a little bit. As a general rule, I'm not competitive as far as, oh, that guy's doing a crazy gimmick. You know, that's my thing. You know, mm-hmm. We were all competitive about wanting a spot on the card, but I was pretty good with what I had. You know, I would mark out for guys who could do stuff I couldn't do. You know, but Ron, I remember Ron Simmons coming in, and Ron has that deep voice, and God, I said, yeah, he goes, Stanley Sherman make your mask? I said, yeah. He goes, made mine too. Mm-hmm. And immediately I was like, wait a second, Stanley Sherman's making masks for another guy in the company? And he goes, you want to see it? And then he unveils the light blue helmet.
For Farouk?
With the light blue
helmet. Egyptian warrior, whatever, 300.
And then I breathed a little sigh of relief. But the woman had told me what my name was going to be, so I was prepared, and I had a plan B. I met with Vince now about the third time, still in the office. To this day, I've not been to his house. Vince. And he goes, you want to hear your name? And I already know what it is. And he goes, in this business, we've had crushers. We've had executioners. We've had destroyers. But we've never had a mutilator. Mutilator. And that's what you are. And then he gave me the name Mason. Mason the Mutilator.
No way.
And I thought, oh, this is dead. This is the equivalent of Stone Cold, you know, when he was, you know,
the ringmaster.
The ringmaster, when he said something about, you know, being ice cold, and they gave him Frosty McFreeze and Chili McFang, you know, like any one of those names. It wouldn't have mattered. Every other thing being the same, you know, the middle finger, the music, the swagger, the stunner. Once Howard Finkel goes, Ice Dagger, he's dead in the water, right? And it would have been hard to overcome Mason the Mutilator. And so I said, well, that's good. I like that. But what if? What if I was Mankind the Mutilator? I pitched as Mankind the Mutilator. I said, I'm not sure I understand. I said, be kind of like a double meaning, you know? I could talk about the destruction of mankind, the future of mankind. He just kind of nodded and took some notes. And then I pitched the idea of having a separate and exit music. And he'd be really interested, and I'd say, this way, the only time my heart is mine is truly at ease after I've caused human suffering. And I get my package at WrestleMania, because I was going to debut the day after Mania. I didn't do any of the activities, because I'm going to debut as a new character the day after Mania. It came out and jumped the Undertaker. It was all kind of off to the races. Even if Mr. McMahon wasn't fully invested, mm-hmm. you know.
And he started off at the top, yeah.
And you know, you get that one shot. Mm-hmm. If it failed, man, I owe a lot to the. I honestly, you know, a lot to the Undertaker and his faith in me, because it didn't matter if Mr. McMahon. It did matter that Vince wasn't on board, but he was like, we're gonna do business. And I was remarking to the guys when I was in Milwaukee 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. 2 weeks, I said, I gathered a few of the guys around. I was like, "Hey, can I tell you a story about this building?" And it's kind of that good feeling where the guys gather around.
They
and
some hear of, what
like,
you the, say, yeah.
Some of the top stars too. It's not just like the younger guys, but it's kind of they're all like in a semicircle. I said, "I walked in this building. It's my first pay per view with the Undertaker, and he starts talking about the match, and it dawns on me that." I'm going over. Hmm. And I said, you have to believe me, it never even entered my mind. It wasn't, I wonder if. It was, he's the Undertaker.
Of course you're losing, yeah.
Of course I'm losing. And I went, wait, I'm going over? And he just, you know, kind of nodded his head. He didn't go into explanation. But what I thought was going to be a two-month program ended up lasting, you know, a couple of years, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, a solid 8 months.
You could always go back to it, yeah.
And we went back to it, we established that. But Mankind, the Mutilator. Yeah, I had my package, it said Mutilator, not Mason, but Mutilator. And when I went out, I actually worked Bob Holly prior to running in on The Undertaker and Justin Hawk Bradshaw. And I came out to the music, they said, Mankind. No Mutilator. Mm. And after I beat Bob with the Mandible Claw, which had been my idea, in comes this piano music. And I was like, man, this is, you know.
They did it.
And I remember Jerry Briscoe coming up to me, you know, he said, I'm going to jump The Undertaker. And he wanted to know what I wanted to do. And I'd always wanted to come off the TV truck with an elbow. Because I thought it's the perfect camera shot, you know. Like I love the idea of coming right into someone's living room, mm-hmm. and I don't think we ever really nailed it, because even if you're doing it on the floor and you have a low camera shot, you're not quite coming into the living room.
Yeah.
It wasn't until I did Backlash with Randy Orton in 2004 where he was like on a platform and I threw him off. He did that slow, agonizing walk because he legitimately had about 100 thumbtacks. Yeah. You had 69.
And that's a true number, by the way. That was not supposed to be that way, but I counted and I said, I'm not going to make it 70. It's 69. I'm going real with this.
Do you remember me grabbing you?
Yes, there's a great picture of you and I where you giving me the Mick Foley Have a Nice Day sign, and I'm like crying with all these stupid tacks all in my body.
I was like, you gotta get photos. I would grab the camera. You can't let that go.
Oh, I know. We filmed every single tack getting taken out as well. Yeah.
But in this case, I wanted to come off the TV truck, and Jerry Briscoe goes, we know you do a lot of... I can't do a Briscoe. I wish I could.
Mick, we know you do a lot of crazy stuff.
We may ask you to do that at some point, but please don't do it until we ask you. Mm. And then as it played out, just to make this clear, people wonder, you know, did you ever have to turn down ideas that WWE had? I said, no, they turned down ideas that I had, where they went, no, I can't be a party to this.
Yeah.
I can't have that on my conscience.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
How in the hell did you convince Vince to do the bump off the cell? Because let me just say one quick thing. We had a Hell in the Cell match, me and Triple H, and I was going to do – I had an idea of doing a crossbody from the top to the floor. And when you're on the floor looking up
– I'm so glad – I know.
It's not so bad.
I'm so glad you said that when I read your book –
Yeah.
Am I jumping in?
Yeah, please.
About the people looking like ants.
Yeah.
And then you said, I'm not exaggerating, they looked like ants.
They did. And I thought to myself, Mick Foley – is the bravest, craziest lunatic ever for even just thinking about this, standing on top looking down.
Yeah.
I was like, I could not do it. I don't know how you did that.
Well, I told a couple of biggest lies of my life that day. There's a lot of people have speculated that I knew that the cage was going to break in the second time. And the truth is, that's way too dangerous. Just going through the cage on a choke slam like that,
that's insane. There's that broke.
Yeah. Well, it was supposed to tear. The big bump was the only thing I had this image of being like stuffed down a rabbit hole that it would give a little bit, and then Taker was going to push me down that hole. And the big visual to me was I'm going to be hanging upside down. You know, like, well, my arms are flailing and this. And then the bump itself is like, all right, then I just have to be able to rotate, land on my hands and knees, you know, maybe a little risk to your wrist, your knee, but nothing real major. And I got approval for that. And then I said, hey, what if I came off the top? And went, absolutely not. And I went into sell mode and I said, well, if I was going to drop an elbow off there and somebody's going to move, you would let me do that, right? You know, it's leading questions. And he's like, I guess, you know. Mm-hmm. And, well, it's the same thing. I'm going to be in total control. And then he said, and then Taker looked at me and said, you've been up there, right? And I said, absolutely. And both he and Vince said, you feel comfortable? I said, yeah, absolutely. And the truth is, if I'd ever walked up, I'd gone up on the top of that cell, no way.
Anybody that's listening to this, trust me, when you get up there looking down, it feels like you're 100 feet.
It's so ridiculous. And even though I don't curse much out loud, I curse in my thoughts. And what I was thinking when I got up there was, you've got to be effing kidding me. If I could have thought of a way to climb back down without destroying my career, I would have done it.
Wow.
And I also didn't realize, being a bottom heavy guy who maxed out at like 4 pull-ups in 6th grade and then got considerably heavy, I had a tremendous time trying to get up that cell. My two of my fingers lost feeling for about 2 weeks, like just clinging on that thing. And if you look at it, my feet are just I couldn't get any
ground. Yeah,
which is why every subsequent cell match has had
foot holes cut out. Yeah.
And it was bad enough to try to get up there that first time. And then going up the second time after I'd gone through, you know, I'd gone through the table. Don't know how I did it, but, you know, credit has to go to Terry Funk, because a lot of credit. My wife looked at me like when I came home, you know, from some of these Japanese tours, because Terry had been my mentor, and she'd see the shape I would come back home in, and she just said, Mick, couldn't you have found a different mentor?
Dick Murdoch be your mentor?
and so Terry went with me, and we went to, you know, I don't know if people know this, you rarely end up in Stamford, Connecticut. You like very rarely are you actually in Stamford. You know, me, maybe a little more than other people that live on Long Island, just about an hour and a half away.
Very rare, though.
Very rare you go through. And on that one day, Terry and I were passing through. We worked out at the gym there. We watched the Cell match with Taker and Shawn Michaels. And I was really worried, because the character, I'd gone through the, you know, the Mankind to... fun-loving Dude Love, Cactus Jack came into the mix. I did all three at once, and then I became corporate Dude Love, and then went back to being Mankind, or which Cactus Jack. And I used the as incentive. I used the fact that after Terry and I had been jumped by the newly reformed DX the night that X-Pac joined in. And we took a heck of a beating, you know. And then it's not, and it's, you know, Sean Waltman's a good friend of mine, but there's something about that Bronco Buster. It's a little degrading, you know. So you're not only taking a beating, but you're getting degraded too.
There's crotch in your face.
Yeah. And you're laying there, and I was laying there, and whoever it was, Finkel or whatever, said, you know, we go to a commercial break, and he says, still to come, so-and-so, so-and-so, and Stone Cold Steve Austin. The crowd starts chanting Austin. And, you know, if you're a competitive person, like, and like I said, we all were, that bothered me. And I thought, I'm going to hold on to this, and I'm going to use it at some point.
The feeling?
The feeling of, you know, of being passed over like that. And I used it as my, you know, my rationale for turning. But by the time I'd been Cactus Jack, then heel Cactus, corporate dude, and now I go back to being Mankind, I could feel the lull. Mm-hmm, you know, like, mm-hmm.
You've lost momentum.
I've lost momentum, and I was like, I didn't know how to get out of it, you know. I mean, I'm lucky Vince Russo had faith in me to put me in a semi-main event. I honestly didn't think I deserved to be in there.
In that match with Taker.
We didn't really have an angle, you know. We had the history. Luckily, we had the history together, but I thought, this isn't, you know, they call it a co-main event, but Steve and Kane were clearly like the, you know, they were the top match, and now to compound my troubles, I'm watching Taker and Shawn, and they just had a brilliant match, you know. And I'm like, I can't do that stuff, you know. Shawn, you know,
that's where Shawn fell off the side of the cage to the table.
Yeah, but just this, you know, he's just so nimble, and you know, he's, you know, honestly, you know, much better than I. You know, I don't think there's any shame in saying he was much better.
He was better than most of us. Yeah,
he was incredible. I noticed you didn't include you and yourself in that stuff.
I said most of us. Yeah, believe me, most of us.
And I was like, what am I going to do? And Terry goes, Cactus, I think you ought to start the match on top of the Cell. And then he goes, you know what? You know, it's the damnedest thing. What if you were thrown off of that Cell? And he's joking around, and he's laughing. And then I said, I think I can do that. I think I can do that. And so that was why I pitched the idea of coming off the first time.
But the thing about it, too, is it's not like you are dropping an elbow or doing a splash. Yeah. You can see. You actually turn.
Yeah.
And that's what freaks me out the most, like turning to where now you can't even see where you're bumping. Did you – no rehearsal.
Right.
No
– never been up there. The TV monitors were still there, you know, and this was before they were like kind of, you know –
unbelievable. So you still felt comfortable enough to do the front bump, though?
Like, no, I didn't feel comfortable. I didn't know how to. I did not know. I was terrified, honestly. Yeah. Like, you know, Shane McMahon convinced has no fear, because he willingly did that, knowing what.
But it's a different vibe, though, Mick. He's doing it his own time. If he wants to take it up, like, you're going when someone throws
you. And no one expected it either.
Right. They'd never seen that.
No one expected it. Yeah. And so it was just so shy. It was so shocking and so prolonged. The reaction was so prolonged, and then the match was over. You know, like 30 seconds, it's over.
How did you feel when you landed?
I felt, I mean, I was hurting for 6 weeks after that, but initial feeling was relief that it was over.
I'm alive.
And that I was, you know, I remember, you know, before we had the barricades we do now, we had the steel, you know.
The old school steel fences.
Yeah. And so my body ended up hitting and then rolling through so that half my body or a third of my lower body was in the crowd, you know. And it was to just be out there and be soaking that in, you know, and having those prolonged chants and not having anyone saying, hey, this is a 30-second, you know, anyone say, come on, you didn't do a four-star match, you didn't hit 18 false finishes. It was just, boom, one move, and we're done.
And that was the end, right?
Well, it was supposed to, yeah, I mean, went up. No one thought they'd been cheated when the gurney was
oh, yeah, because that was the finish. It was the finish.
Yeah.
It was like
but then it rolled off the gurney. Remember rolling the gurney? And when I went up, if I could have one thing to do differently, and I'm not talking about the bump, you know, that was, I mean,
Which bump? The one off the top or one through the cage?
Yeah. I was, you know, I'd taken quite a blow there, and I was even slower getting up that thing. I just wish I could have exchanged with Taker, because the adrenaline, you know, when they realized he's going back up. I mean, I'm getting goosebumps thinking about it now. Like, it was a crazy feeling, you know. It was like coming off there and having JR, you know, really just commanding the moment, you know, and King was at the top of his game. And it was like, you know, and here's the height of, like, you know, excitement. And then here comes a chokeslam. The only time I didn't have much hop in my, you know, my legs, but I always got up for chokeslams. There's always, if I was in chokeslam with Taker, I was always high up there, you know. And this is the one time that my feet never left the cage. And I'm lucky because had they left, if I'd gotten up and been up there like I was and come down and that mesh gave way, then I would have landed high on my shoulders and neck.
Maybe even on your head.
And I don't think I ever would have – honestly, I don't think I ever would have wrestled again. Yeah. It was bad as it was. I mean, you're looking now at – I got the, you know, the two teeth. Two more have to go.
It's hard for you to walk.
Yeah,
You can see how it was.
Well, that, I mean, the walking, you know, that's compounded. It's hard to say which.
I'm sure that didn't help.
But this is one where you go, well,
Those teeth are actually from.
Yeah, I had these teeth. Now they're gone. I still need to have two more out because of the blow they took.
Are they dead?
Yeah, they're dead, and they're rotting. And so it's like, all right, now I got to get two more, and it's going to take 6 months and $15,000, 19 years after the match. Mm. It's like still with me every single day.
You live with it for the rest of your life. Yeah.
So
what was the reaction when you came back through the curtain? Like, what did Vince say?
The crazy thing was, I was out. I didn't remember large chunks of that match until then. I started piecing it together. I remember these my McMahon interactions. Vince came up to me after the show and he said, and I do remember this, you know, he said, "You have no idea how much I appreciate what you've just done for this company, but I never want to see anything like that again." Mm-hmm. And that's like, I think it's pretty telling. You know, Vince, I think, gets a, you know, bad rap for, you know. I honestly believe, you know, I'd be in far worse shape. If I'd been allowed to do what I wanted to do, and B, if he hadn't that day, I'm going to place a governor.
Vince does that all the time.
Yeah.
You know, cut stuff off.
Yeah.
You know.
And the other McMahon interaction, I talked about this in my that promo I mentioned, the September promo with Stephanie. I felt like we needed to establish why am I the GM? Because it wasn't like you and Stephanie, we had a long history. Mm-hmm. I'd been the GM for 6 months and kind of given her a hard time, but no one knew, like, you know, I'd never been alluded to that I was friends with Stephanie. And she told me the first time, I didn't remember because I was so out of it. And I said, "No, when was it?" She said, "It was Hell in a Cell. I had just had the match, and I got the word that Pat Patterson's partner, Louie, had passed away from a heart attack."
That day.
Wow. And Stephanie said, "You walked," this first time she'd ever seen me, she said, "You walked in after that match, you're in a terrible, you can barely walk." You know, in her mind, the tooth was still in my nose. I don't know if it was or not. And she said, "And you hugged Pat, And the only way I probably knew that who she was there with her mom, Linda. She said, you know, and you just kind of looked over and you gave me a crooked smile. And that was the first time that I think that's pretty heavy, you know, to meet someone under those circumstances.
Right.
And you know that feeling. It's like the honeymoon period that next day after you've had a good match and
everyone's and congratulating you.
And especially that bond you have with the guy you've had the match with. Even if you know that you may, you know, now you're gonna be competitors for a spot on the card, but you're gonna allow yourself that time, assuming that you both, you know, enjoyed the match, and you know, like it's funny, is I don't know Undertaker that well, like you know, like, and I like it that way, like I like the idea. I will joke and say, I said at my Hall of Fame induction, like he doesn't tweet, you know, you don't see.
Yeah.
LOL, the dead man, a little emoji-con smile. But that day, he stayed with me for a long time, you know, and it was like, he was like my big brother. And if it had been someone else, I wouldn't have been able to get through that match, you know. Like, trying to pick up the pieces when one of the guys is not conscious.
Oh, it's a horrible feeling.
And he did say, you know, he did try to bring it home. And how I convinced him that I still had something left, you know, I don't know. And, you know, he went old school. This is where I was able to buy some time. I would joke, you know, when I would do my shows, and I'd say, we don't stop matches in WWE. We don't stop matches. We buy time.
That's true.
And so he went old school, and he had me by the wrist, and I probably worked 100 matches with Taker. You'll hear some veterans say they worked 1,000 times.
Yeah,
guy,
yeah.
I believe 100 puts me up there with, you know, among the most matches you have with anybody. And I was always really animated. You know, he'd go old school and the rest of my body would be thrashing around, you know, whoa, selling it. And on that night in Pittsburgh, the right arm is up in the air and the rest of my body is just like dead, limp.
Yeah.
And then I knocked into the ropes and he fell off and then the clouds started to, you know.
Dissipate, yeah.
Yeah, dissipate.
Did you get a good payoff for that match?
I did, yeah. I wasn't expecting it, you know, because I was, you know, used to getting a certain amount, and it was well above that range.
And rightfully so.
But it wasn't like I did it with the expectation.
No.
And I think it's really – I don't know how payoffs are given now with the network, but it's not like people are working less hard.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, there's no pay-per-view anymore, so that tells you all you need to know about how payoffs are. It's different now.
But guys go out there and they still, you know, the work ethic is just unbelievable. And like in your case, you know, I'm not saying anything to your face that I haven't said behind your back, which is you had this amazing year. Like, who would have thought, right?
Unbelievable.
You were doing the thing. You put me over for a while, so I'll put you over now. You do the time-honored thing if you respect the business. You come in, you do a bunch of shots, you work with some of the other guys, you do the right thing, and then you leave. And then you repeat, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was getting to a point, you know, where even the kayfabe news says Jericho makes surprise return for like
15th time.
But if someone would have said, yeah, he's now going to work for a year and a half, he's going to have a list.
He's going to get a scarf over, a clicking pen.
And the best friend with no homoerotic overtones.
Yeah, right.
And then when I heard you guys doing that, and it was like, I remember being there on that. I don't know why I was there. I wasn't the GM yet. You guys were doing that long before, you know, I became the GM. But I happened to have been at that TV, and it was almost like you were doing that great thing where you would be caught lying and everyone would know you would lie. And you would then try, instead of admitting it, you backtrack.
Apple.
And you would make
Big Apple. Appleton.
And you said something about a friend, and then Kevin walked in. You know, Kevin, I think anyone who watches Kevin knows he's a tough dude, right?
Yeah.
And, like, he could have stepped on what you were doing. He was like, I'll be your friend, or something like that.
Yeah,
I got your back.
Yeah. The Jim and Marvin Luter thing.
And it was like, you will? And within 2 weeks, you were proclaiming yourselves to be best friends.
Yeah.
And one of the regrets I have, you know, in my role as GM is, you know, in some ways I found my feet, in some ways I was still just trying not to make mistakes, which is not how you do your best stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I never found a way to give you guys props as to what you meant for the show on the show. And I didn't know how to do that because you guys were always so dastardly, you know, interfering in matches, you know. It's like my hands are kind of tied, you know.
Yeah.
And we did have some nice interactions, you know. I was actually set to go home after the Pittsburgh pay-per-view to do Santa stuff. And Vince said, well, Mick, you know, I just want you to know what you'll be missing. And I said, what's that? He goes, well, we've got Chris Jericho, and he's going to be suspended above the ring in a shark tank, and you have to talk him into getting in there. All right, I'll drive home after. And so I drove home in one shot from Youngstown, Ohio, to sing Must Be Santa with Norah Jones. And I would practice like literally 200 times, like a 3-minute song, 200 times in a row. Must Be Santa. Like just so tired, you know, when you're so tired.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I came back specifically to do, you know, stayed there specifically to do that. And I thought we...
it was a great one.
It was good how you managed to talk yourself into. Yeah, yeah. But fully, these bars are made. These are cheap.
Aluminum.
No, it's steel. Go ahead, and check it out.
It's safe.
This floor is going to break. No, no, it's not. Go in there, and check it out. This lock will never hold me. Yes, it will.
But see, you've always been like, and here's something too. It's on a personal note. I was like, you know, Foley, you've never liked me, but that's not the case because you did help me get into ECW and indirectly WCW. But I vaguely remember, and I don't think we've ever really talked about it. You came to our show in Japan.
In Japan, yeah.
You were off that day?
You came to one of ours, like where we had a pretty good house.
We had an off day. Yeah, so I took the train somewhere to come see you with Masa.
Yeah. Right. And then you and I, and you actually read, you know, it's read and spoke some Japanese, and I had the Cactus Jack King of the Death match, you know, King of the Death. What I didn't realize, if it's written in Japanese in Japan, they don't want it.
Yeah.
And if you bring it to the U.S., you know, and it's English, they don't want, you know, they want it. So it's kind of like, it was neither fish nor fowl, as they say. But we had a pretty, you know, we were starting to draw a little bit. It was sold out.
That was,
you know.
Was it Wing or was it?
No, it was
IWA Japan. That's it, right?
Yeah. And then when I had the off day, so when I said we were drawing, I mean, maybe we had, 1,500. It was a good crowd. Because we had been used to get, you know, Terry Funk and I, you know, were killing each other in front of 150 people. Mm. And that's why I look back on that time with so much pride. It was like...
You built the territory.
We built it. We felt like, all right, maybe there's only 150 people there, but within 3 days, you're going to be up to 500,000 people reading baseball magazine in full color, you know?
The wrestling magazine that's called Baseball Magazine.
Yeah, I could never...
Classic
never,
Japanese,
I could never figure that out. Mm-hmm. Or I could never figure out why you either had... When it came to using the facilities, it was either a hole in the ground, porcelain hole in the ground, or the most lavish toilet you've ever had in your
life.
With
heated seats and a bidet and like it's electronic.
No, yeah.
And by the way, there's nothing worse than having to use the porcelain hole in the ground.
Oh,
especially for us with our screwed up knees and everything. Yeah. So you came to our show with Masa, who's a super fan, great guy, friend to all the foreign wrestlers, and kind of takes you out and takes care of you. He's not a sponsor.
No,
he's just a friend.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you had that great match with Ultimo Dragon.
Right. Yeah.
You guys were
it was Budokan? It was Sumo Arena.
Sumo Arena.
Our third anniversary show,
And you really tore it down. Mm-hmm. And I went over, you know, when I went back to ECW, have you seen Chris Jericho? And I think you'd been on his, you know, list.
I've been calling him once a week for like a year.
And so we, so you got in there and I had my second to last ECW match with you. And this was it was such a weird dynamic because I was the anti-hardcore heel. And when I turned heel there, it was like, well, what do you do? Like, you can't be vicious because they like that. You can't insult the fans.
How do you be a heel in ECW?
I started systematically taking away everything they liked about me, you know?
Right.
I shaved and, you know, started pushing.
Rest holds.
Yeah, rest holds. Yeah, I mean, it was pretty – I remember Steve got hot when I got a one-star review in one of the sheets, and he was like, it wasn't – He goes, it was a 4-star, 1-star match or something like that.
Yeah,
it was bad by design and accomplished something a lot more than a great match would have. But that night in the venue in Queens, the hall wanted 50% of the merchandise money.
50, really?
50%. This isn't 50% after what you paid. So it's like, you know, at that time, you know, you're selling them for $15. They cost you $7.
Right.
That's
your profit.
Nothing. So I sent my t-shirt guy out to sell him on the line, and he came back like 3 minutes later. He's got like 3 loogies on him. he hadn't, like, people were really angry, you know? And you and I went out. We had a good match.
We did have a good match. I remember that.
We'll look back at a couple of those minutes, you know, at a couple of those minutes, we're like back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And that began that long pattern of me never defeating you.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But what a way for me to come into ECW and beat, you know, Cactus Jack. I think you were Cactus Jack at the time. Yeah, to beat Cactus Jack, like, my second match in. Like, what a debut for me. You know, it was a great thing for you to do that.
Glad to do it, kid.
And then you never—I beat you every other time every except time for the Hall of Fame.
Hall of Fame,
which you called me about 6 months before and said, "I kind of have this idea," and then we never really discussed it again. I just remember you up there. I remember said to my wife, "Like I'm going up there. I think he wants me to go up there. I'm just going to do it."
I legitimately got this idea. I may have only told – I think I told you the year before. If I didn't
– I think it was. It was like the biggest podcast ever. It was the biggest speech ever.
Because I got this feeling – and I was kind of on the outs with the company, but yet I was doing the pre-show. This was the year 2013. I don't know why I was on the, I don't know. I think I just get on the outs so I can come back and be accepted. It's all of it.
Take your 15th surprise return.
It's all about getting that hug from Vince at the end of the day. It is.
Oh, it's like your dad, right?
So if you're on a steady ground, there's never that.
If you're always friends with them, it's never good, right?
You need to have that return.
Yeah.
And I was walking, from that Miami arena, and I just started legitimately thinking, wait a second, you know, you're probably going to be inducted, you know, like it's a matter of when, time. You know. And I thought next year they're at
the Garden,
Allstate, whatever the big stadium was. I was like, it makes sense that the Hall of Fame would be at the Garden. And if it's going to be at the Garden, like, you know, I've got the history of the Garden. And then I just got this idea, like, I want to drop an elbow on Chris Jericho. At that time, I was going to come off the stage. You know, would you be willing to stay down there? And the funny thing is, when I was doing the one-man show, and I would actually like to reprise this for the network because it's kind of timeless. It's specific to Hall of Fame WrestleMania. So it's not, you know, it would be new every year because it's specific about that. And I would talk about the Foley risk-reward ratio analysis that I would instantaneously figure out whether a move was worth doing or not. And I would give, for example, you know, we were under direct orders not to do anything. No, do not take a pedigree on the thumbtacks, you know, because we were to use them to take a backdrop in with me and Hunter at the New York Street fight
in
Royal Rumble 2000. And then Hunter gave me that pedigree, and I kicked out. Like, no one kicked out of the pedigree at that time. And all of a sudden, it was like, you know, all this data. We're like, okay, you know, what if I take the pedigree and those thumbtacks? And it was like, okay, you could possibly lose an eye.
Yeah.
And then the thing I kept coming back to is, but think of the pop. You know, like, think of the pop. And it was like, it was too good. So we called the audible. We took the heat, whatever heat was. But we had such a, you know, we had a very good, one of the best.
Classic,
it was a great really match. It was, thanks. I didn't want to say great, but it was great.
Yeah, it put him on the map as a top star.
It was good for both of us.
Yeah.
Because I would had been so banged up, and I'd been relying more and more on humor, and it gave me a chance to kind of go out as Cactus Jack. That and the match that followed the next month, the cell match that took place 17 years ago.
Right.
And then I talked about the risk-reward ratio analysis, and I go back to that night in the Garden, and you rolled up on that stage, and I kind of panicked, and then Punk rolled up on the stage.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
He was the ref.
Yeah. And you were on the stage first, and I did the risk reward ratio analysis. Like, all I have to do is drop an elbow, not like off the second rope. And I did the analysis, and the data I came up with is, this is going to hurt for 2 weeks. And then once Punk came up, I was like, I can't not do it. And do you remember what I said to you?
What?
I go, you're going to have to take all the impact on this.
Oh, I know. I was just going to say the risk-reward ratio on my end was I'm on a stage with, at the time, you're probably 300 pounds, dropping elbow.
More than that,
There's nowhere for me to bump. There's no give. Yeah. It's a stage.
Yeah,
so that hurt on me too.
And you look like Morocco looked when he was taking Snuka Splash. You're like, you had to, you know.
Yeah, I was all clenched in. My arms were all flexed.
Biceps there. And I came down. It was the only way I could do it without hurting myself for weeks. And then when it got a phenomenal response.
Yeah.
My one regret is when I got on that microphone and said, yo, Adrian, I did it. I was like, you know what? that's all she wrote. You can't get any higher than that.
Mm-hmm.
You should have taken it home.
Yeah, instead,
I talked for another 20 minutes. But, I think it was one of those moments people will never forget.
Yeah.
And guys were like, when did you work that out? I was like, I didn't work it out.
It just came up. Because I remember you had talked to me about it like a year prior.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a great photo of that people have where the three of us have signed it.
And a little known fact about that photo is partially/largely responsible for the funding of the Santa documentary.
Oh.
Because the Kickstarter was really lagging, and then the big incentive was the photo signed by me, you, and Punk.
That's where it is.
Yeah.
That's right.
And that was like the $200 item, and that's when we met our goal.
That went.
You know? Because if you don't meet the goal on Kickstarter, you get nothing.
Yeah, right.
And the movie probably would have come out, but it wouldn't have had the money for the graphic.
Well, just as we wind down here, just a few more things. Let's talk about your new book coming out that's about Santa.
Yeah.
You love Santa Claus.
I do love Santa. And I started writing this book, and I know going in, there's what's the audience? You know, it's not a book for wrestling fans. You know, there is quite a bit of wrestling in there. But it's not a book for 18, 19-year-old. It's probably a book for people it's a book for people who love Christmas,
mm-hmm.
and it's not likely that people who love Christmas are going to buy it because it's also a wrestling. You know, it's mm-hmm. kind of like again, talking about neither fish nor fowl.
Right.
Which I never use it. I never say those words, but it's
twice
like,
in one show.
That's the hard thing. It doesn't have an audience. And the other thing, when I'm writing, I was like, this is really, really personal, very personal stuff. And I thought, I don't feel comfortable putting it out there. And I had kind of made a decision. I remember telling Stephanie would ask me about it. You know, Stephanie's a good writer. I don't know if you've ever, you know, Stephanie's a very good writer. And one day she came to catering and she sat down and she started. I'd written a synopsis because WWE was going to publish the book at one point. And I'd written a synopsis and she wanted to know more about it, you know, and specifically she wanted to know the role that Nora Jones had played in my evolution as Santa Claus. You had to throw in a little name drop. And so I started talking to Stephanie, and I realized like a bunch of time had gone by, like 45 minutes. And I was like, oh, you want to do our promo? And she was saying, oh, I came to talk to you about the book. And I went, really? And I said, do you think it's interesting? And she was like, I think it's fascinating. And it really made me feel like, you know what? You put the best thing you can out there, and then you hope it finds an audience, mm-hmm. which it might over the course of time. And you know, I'm donating the profits from the hardcover to four different Christmas charities, so it's not like I think it's going to be.
So it's based around your love of Christmas.
It's five. You know what? It's what's cool about it is I thought if I wait another year or two, now I'm doing. You know how like. And there have been very good books that look back on a huge wrestling star's career. But looking back over 30 years, you got to kind of pick and choose.
Yeah.
And one thing I liked, hopefully you take this as the compliment it is, because it's also complimenting my book. I thought you and I did a good job of bringing people into the moment because we weren't covering such huge chunks of time. You're now on your sixth.
Oh, this is fourth.
Oh, four. Okay. Yeah. But you're able to go a little deeper into matches, whereas, you know, other guys are talking about monumental matches, and they can only give it a paragraph.
Because they have to do their whole career in 300 pages. It don't work that way.
And right? I knew I had a good story with a five-year arc where definite lessons were learned,
mm-hmm.
and I was a much better person at the end of the 5 years than I was when I started it. And it had been something that had really helped me out in a major way when I couldn't rest. You know, the difference between retiring and, you know, I'm coming back and one match. When you're in a neurologist's office and he says you should never wrestle again, there's a sense of finality. It's relieving, but it's also.
You're done.
Yeah, you're done.
Yeah.
And it's like this thing that I love doing. Is not an option. There are no comebacks, you know, ever. Mm-hmm. And then right on the shoulders of that, like no roller coasters, boom, the sensitivity to lights, no volunteering, you know, for the rain stuff, done. And it was like mm-hmm. within 2 weeks, like everything that I loved doing was kind of gone. And I was hurting, you know, emotionally. Like, you know, I was still in that period where, you know, everything kind of felt muted and underwater. I was having a tough time. And this Santa thing came out and just filled a void. Like, you know, it was like when that first kid came in. And hello, Carson, how are you? And
this is when you're playing Santa.
I
mean, yeah,
I wasn't playing him. I wasn't
you
playing
were Santa.
I transformed him. And there's a moment in the documentary, I'm assuming a lot of people didn't see the documentary.
It's a great documentary. What's it called? Santa?
I Am Santa Claus.
I Am Santa Claus.
And it's legit. You couldn't script this.
Yeah.
Where I have this little kid on my lap. And I said, what would you like for Christmas? He goes, a ball. I said, I think Santa can make you a very special ball. I had my son Huey with me. I said, I'll put my number one elf on it. Santa's got that kind of pull at the North Pole. I said, is there anything else you'd like? And he goes, another ball. And I go, okay, two. And it just hits my head. It's like being in the ring and ad-libbing. And I realize I can't. I said, two round athletic spheres. And, you know, I came out of that experience. I was like, wow. You know, it was like a major door had been opened for me. And checking out of the hotel the next day, my wife was late, you know, running late. And, kind of a blessing because now I'm looking through my, you know, photos. We'd taken a few photos. There's a great photo of my daughter. Me and my daughter, she's sitting next to me. It's a cool photo for me as a dad because here my daughter is 19 at the time. She wasn't embarrassed at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, wow, I look pretty good. And I was like, I got one shot. I'm not going to bother five people, six people. I'm going to send this to one person. And so I sent a text to Stephanie, and I said, if I show you a photo, will you look at it? And she said, sure. And I sent it over. I said, ho, 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 from old St. Nick. And she writes back, is that you? I said, yeah. I said, you want to see if they'd like me to do tribute to the troops? And and then the one, instead of being one and done, now, you know, now I'm on TV. And then that's own set of problems where the expectations are, I had the best time in front of 30 kids. And
right.
Now I'm in front of millions.
Mm-hmm.
And you get that. And so that's one of the lessons I learned by the fifth year. But
what's the book called?
It's called, it's going to be called St. Mick.
St. Mick.
St. Mick. And the reason I decided to publish it is I just happened to be looking at the verified tweets, you know, so you're not getting hammered by too many people complaining about your job as GM. And there was a writer who responded to a question about his favorite interview, and he said, no question, at Real Mick Foley. And so I go on his profile, and I saw that he just started a small publishing house. So I give it the worst sales pitch of all time. And I go, listen, I said, would you be interested in a book that's gotten really no audience. I don't want a large print number. I don't want to be out. I don't want to promote it much because I don't want to be sick of it. That's one of the things. I don't know if you found that. If you push something, by the time you're done, you essentially don't ever want to see it
again.
Yeah, yeah. And I didn't want to get to that moment. And so, yeah, we're doing it. And I'm really happy with it. You know, I went in and did some editing on my own. Mm-hmm. They're giving it another edit. And I think, you know, the books, it doesn't matter if it sells, you know, 100 copies, or it's not going to sell 100,000, mm-hmm. but it's the fact that it's there on a shelf and it's kind of timeless, and 100 years from now, someone could pick it up and be touched by it.
Or read it on Kindle. How many books is this for you now?
This would be six, five.
Five. All right, and I got to go back in and write
two
another
novel.
Oh, jeez. Kids book.
Yeah, yeah. So this is number 11 for me.
Jeez, man.
But six. You and I are formidable. We've got nine memoirs between us. No one else has more than one.
People must be sick of our last thing. There's a famous match, and if I'm wrong about this, I'm not. There's the match that you guys were in San Jose, you and Owen Hart. Knowing that Dave Meltzer was going to be there and going out there to have the worst match. Can you tell us about that?
It's very liberating, you know, because we'd been having stinkers. And the goal was to try to get Steve was coming back from the neck injury, but he was such a draw, you know, that, you know, once he was recovering, you know, be brought on the road to be my second. And Owen and I were just trying to get him to break character and laugh. And we almost had him. You know, Steve would laugh backstage. He was pretty
in the ring.
Protective.
He was stone cold. Yeah,
he was definitely stone cold. And in Anaheim, the night before we did San Jose, we almost had him when I opened up a box of soft drink lids on Owen. You know, and I pour them out. They're fluttering to the ground. Fluttering, and Owen's knees are buckling. You know, he's doing the walk around the ring, and they're fluttering like harmless butterflies. And Steve, he popped backstage.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't pop in the ring. And then we were like, hey, I think we can get him. And then I don't know, it was me or Owen. It was like, wait a second, San Jose, Dave Meltzer's going to be in the audience. We can't have a stinker in San Jose. And it was like, yeah, we can. Yeah, we can. And like, we went out of our way, you know, to find like even worse props. And in that case, you know, going through concessions, I see the giant Santa's sack size of popcorn. And what finally got Steve is then, you know, when I'm hammering Owen over the back with the giant sack of popcorn again, his knees are buckling. And but then he rakes the eyes or something. There's all this popcorn debris in the ring. And when I start going down and selling, it looks like I'm just wildly thrashing about. But I'm actually like doing the angel, the popcorn angel. And I get up, and there's this big angel print with the, you know, the bowling pin physique, you know, like definitely getting wider at the base. And I look over at Steve, and I'll curse. What is bring it home with a curse word? He's got his arm in his head, but he's beet red. And he would wear that vest, you know, the black vest, and you could see those huge lats shaking, you know. And he goes, I look at his face, and he's got tears streaming down his face. He goes, you guys are the shits. And it was such a triumph, you know, like we did it. We got him to pop. It was in front of Dave Meltzer. We know we're going to get the half a star done. It was like, we had to do it. Much better than talking about the time we tore down the house in San Jose, four-star match. And I got to tell you, I'll just leave you with this. I'd like some solidarity among the old school guys who know the legend of the Rock and Roll Express. So that if Ricky Morton does not at some point say, brother, we sold this son of a bitch out, I say me, you, and Steve, we hit the stage.
Mick, this has definitely been the greatest podcast ever. The biggest podcast ever. Awesome talking to you, man.
You know, I was afraid that with all the buildup, are we still on?
Yeah, we're still on.
I was afraid it was going to be the podcasting equivalent of like predicting hot sex and then just cuddling. Yeah. But I think we came through with the hot
sex. We did good.
Yeah, big time.
Some good hot verbal audio sex. There you go. Foley and Jericho, audio sex. There's the title.
Thanks again to Mick for being part of the biggest podcast ever. What a great storyteller, great guy, longtime friend. And be on the lookout for his Christmas book, Saint Mick, coming out in a few months. And while I'm rolling out the thank yous, big one, of course, to all of you for supporting Talk is Jericho and the tremendous sponsors who make it possible. DDP Yoga. Go to ddpyoga.com/Jericho to get 30% off the DDP Yoga Now app and all DDP Yoga related merch. BetDSI. Register at BetDSI.com. Use my promo code Jericho25 to get $25 for free and a 200% bonus on your first deposit. Then there's NatureBox. Feed that hunger, man. Go to NatureBox.com/Jericho. Get 50% off your first order. And then, of course, don't forget about the Jericho Network. Big congrats to Raven. The Raven Effect is the newest smash hit on the Jericho Network. Raven's talking about anything and everything that gets into his head. If you haven't heard this one yet, check it out. It is hilarious. It's the crazy world of Raven. For sure. He and Cyrus had a great battle of the IQs on Killing the Town. That episode just came out on Tuesday. You'll have to give it a listen to find out just who won that battle. But the Jericho Network is keeping you entertained all week long. Raven Effect every Monday. Killing the Town with Storm and Cyrus on Tuesday. Beyond the Darkness scaring the crap out of you 5 days a week. And of course, Keeping it 100 with Conan dropping on Thursdays. And go hit subscribe on iTunes. Leave everyone a rating and a review. Do it for Talk is Jericho as well. I want to get up to 2,000 comments. I need 2,000 comments on iTunes on the Talk is Jericho show there. That's the goal. People, I know you can help me get there. It'll be a huge help to this show with advertising and getting more guests. So go over to iTunes and leave a rating for Talk is Jericho. Do it for your mama. Hit the comment section on iTunes. Let me know what you're digging and who you want to hear on this show, blah, blah, blah. And I didn't forget about Team Tiger Awesome, the hilarious TTA. Sunday mornings, they're bringing you fake ads, weird pop culture mashups, and of course, one of my favorite things, the Team Tiger Awesome fake news.
This is the news with Team Tiger Awesome. In local news, a woman just can't after her coworker put his bare feet on his desk at work today. Witnesses say Diane from accounting, whose desk gives her the most direct line of sight to her colleague's naked toes, asked literally everyone in the office, quote, I mean, that's just gross, right? More on this story as it develops.
Snapchat introduced new filters for International Women's Day, allowing snappers to apply a filter to look like iconic women Marie Curie, Frida Kahlo, or even Rosa Parks. These filters gave Marie Curie glam lashes and exploding chemicals and gave a unibrow and lightened eyes to Frida, and Rosa filter users received the equivalent of digital blackface, which is an absolute slap in the face to all the older people who remember just how long it used to take to apply shoe polish to your face to be offensive.
This has been the news with Team Tiger Awesome. For more, listen to the Team Tiger Awesome show every Sunday right here on the Jericho Network.
Well, there you go. This week also, I think TTA talked about fictional movie characters that should be in jail. Maybe Kevin McAllister. I'm not sure. But anyways, you want to check that out. Spread the word about the Jericho Network. Entertain you all week long. Thanks for listening. Keep listening for the 60-second AP News headlines coming up next on Wednesday. Come on down. My favorite guest host in WWE Raw history, Bob Barker, will be here on Talk is Jericho. He is the OG Price is Right host, animal activist, and once again, my favorite guest host on WWE Monday Night Raw a few years ago. Barker, I will take you on anytime, any place, anywhere. He's a show business legend, a show business icon. He's almost in his 90s, and he's here on Talk is Jericho on Wednesday. We will see you then. Stay hard, stay hungry, peace, love, and hugs. And in the meantime and in between time, yeah, boy. Have a good weekend, guys.
You can download new episodes of Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.